From California to the New York, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land is made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts, and all.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Good evening. Here at the People Speak, we believe in this People Speak, we make a difference. Tonight, the People Speak with an incredible human being from with an incredible ancestry. Arun Gandhi is the grandson of the legendary Mohandas K. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and runs the Institute for Peace and Nonviolence. Its mission, he says, has been to inform the younger generation, in particular, what his philosophy is and why it should be part of our lives. Arun was born in 1934 in Durban, South Africa. He is the fifth grandson of India's legendary leader. Growing up under the discriminatory apartheid laws of South Africa, he was beaten down by white South Africans for being black, and black South Africans for being too white. Arun sought for an eye-to-eye justice. However, he learned from his parents and grandparents that justice does not mean revenge. It means transforming the opponent through love and understanding. Arun, welcome to the show, and thank you for being with us this evening, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Arun, the Mohandas Gandhi Institute for Peace and Nonviolence was originally started by your grandfather and father in South Africa. Can you, can you tell us a little bit about what happened to the institute in South Africa and why you and your wife, Sananda, started here in Memphis, Tennessee?
Yeah, the one in South Africa, which was started in 1903, when my grandfather developed the philosophy of nonviolence as a result of the discrimination that he faced in South Africa. And that institution was run by my father and my mother for almost 80 years. And in 1985, the apartheid government instigated the African people to riot against the Indians, and specifically to burn down and destroy this institution. And so the place was totally ruined and looted and burned, and the land was taken over by 20,000 squatters. And so the whole place is totally lost forever. And when my wife and I saw this in 1988 when I went there, and I saw this, I felt that the work that my parents had put into this should not be in ashes. It should be something living and continuous. And that's why we decided to start this institute. Originally, we wanted the institute to be in South Africa to replace the one that was destroyed. But that, at that time, the South African government wasn't willing to give us the permission to start the institute there, and so I decided to start it here in the United States.
And you said at that time, are you suggesting that they may possibly allow you to open an institute now in South Africa?
Yes, I think now with the change in government and the African National Congress being more sympathetic towards nonviolence, possibly they may allow me to start an institute there. But Now I think it's a bit late for me. I am 74 years old and I don't have the same energy to start, you know, working in two different continents. So
do you think that there would be others that may want to pick up the work that you do in South Africa?
Maybe. I think somebody may come up and start this. I don't know. I will not put any pressure on any family member or anybody to do this. It has to come from within. So I will leave it to their conscience to decide what they want to do and when they want to do it.
Well, that would be wonderful. How exciting to have something like that resurge back in the place where it was originally started. May I ask you, where did you get your inspiration from to continue the work of your grandfather and father?
Well,
was that your conscience that came about?
Yes, it was. It was my conscience. It was also the experience that I had from my birth. When I saw my parents living it and teaching it all their life, it kind of just flowed through me, and I felt as I grew up that I should also, I have a legacy, and I should share that legacy with as many people as possible. I can't be selfish and keep it to myself.
Being the grandson, the fifth grandson of Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi, what an awe-inspiring feeling that must be. Do you have any memories of your grandfather that you would care to share with us?
Yeah, many memories. In fact, you know, as you said in the introduction, I was beaten up in South Africa and I suffered a lot of prejudices, and I was very young then. I was 10 years old when this happened, and I was very angry and very determined to get revenge, because I, like most people, I thought justice means eye for an eye. And that's when my parents took me to India, and I got the opportunity to live with grandfather. And the first lesson that he taught me was about understanding anger and being able to channel that energy into positive action. He used the analogy of electricity, and he said anger is like electricity. It's just as useful and just as powerful as electricity is, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So just as we channel electrical energy and bring it into our lives and use it for the good of humanity, we must learn to channel anger in the same way so that we can use this energy for the good of humanity rather than abuse the energy and cause death and destruction. And I think that's a very powerful lesson that he taught me, and it transformed my life. And I'm sure that if we teach this lesson to all the young people today, they will not abuse their anger, but they will use that energy in positive action. I think that's the first step in learning about nonviolence, and it's also a very useful step in daily practice.
How did Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi take on the role of Mahatma? For those of you that don't know, Mahatma means great soul. Is this a title that's presented? Is it some kind of a form of anointment that takes place? How does one become designated Mahatma?
No, there's no ceremony attached to it. It's just that the people, in his case, the people decided that he was a great person because he had achieved great things, and so they began to call him Mahatma. He didn't like the title. He said, please don't call me a Mahatma. I'm just an ordinary person. But the people were so enamored by his achievement that they refused to listen to him, and that title stuck to him, and nobody could do anything about it. So it's through your work and not by anything else.
How long was he known as Mahatma? How early on was he known as that?
He started being called Mahatma, I think, in the very early 30s. I think it was after the Salt March, or during the Salt March in 1930, that he became known as the Mahatma, and people started calling him Mahatma Gandhi.
You know, a lot of people saw the movie with Ben Kingsley, Gandhi, and were awestricken by the powerful role that he played. First of all, of a most magnificent human being. And many, when Ben Kingsley went back to India, there were times, I think it was either in India or South Africa, that he was actually treated like the Mahatma. It was almost like they wanted him to return to them. Was the movie anything like your memories of your grandfather, Arun?
Yes, it was. In fact, I was very surprised to see what a wonderful movie it was, and especially Ben Kingsley's role there was so much like grandfather that I just felt like he had come to life again. And the movie was about the person and his philosophy, and that was very well projected. It was not meant to be a historic documentary. And so those who looked at the movie as a historic documentary were disappointed, because he did take some liberties in history, which is natural. Otherwise, the film could become longer than it was.
Well, Ben Kingsley certainly did a magnificent job. I have to say, I was just unbelievable. When you just said grandfather, did you call him grandfather?
Yes, I always called him grandfather, and in the Indian language we called him Bapu, which means grandfather. But to me, he was always a grandfather, a very loving grandfather, and so I can't call him anything else.
He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1937, in 1938, in 1939, in 1947, and for the fifth time he was nominated posthumously after he was assassinated in January of 1948. Do you know if there is still a possibility that he will become posthumously recognized by the Nobel Committee?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they will give it, because the Nobel Committee says that they don't award posthumous peace prizes. And so I don't think he'll ever get it now.
Amazing. Just that one of the greatest heroes of the peace movement. How do you feel about him not receiving the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, it's sad. I felt very sad about it. But, the earlier nominations were put down by the British because they didn't want him to be recognized and given a Nobel Peace Prize. And then he was assassinated, and then the Nobel Committee said that we have never offered anybody posthumous awards, and we are not going to start doing that now. And yet so many people have got the Peace Prize because of their Gandhian work. I mean, in their, in the recognition, they say, for following Gandhi's footsteps. Mandela and so many others, Wallace and all of them got a Nobel Peace Prize because of their Gandhian nonviolence work.
Jawaharlal Nehru, on February the 2nd, 1948, made this statement in a eulogy for your grandfather. He said, "A glory has departed, and the sun that warmed and brightened our lives has set, and we shiver in the cold and the dark." How did you feel when your grandfather was assassinated, sir?
I felt terrible. After living with him for about a year and a half, the family had decided to go back to South Africa. And so we left India in November of 1947, just after independence. And so we were in South Africa when we heard the news. And I was so shocked that I just couldn't believe anybody could kill such a loving and kind person. And I felt that momentary anger. And I told my parents, I said, "I wish I was there. I would have throttled the person who did this." And my parents reminded me of the lessons that my grandfather taught me. And they said that he wouldn't appreciate that at all. He would appreciate your learning to forgive people who do such things and try to change them. And they helped me considerably in learning to forgive such a person.
And so, therefore, you did forgive the killer of this great man, your grandfather.
Yes. Yes.
That's amazing in and of itself, I have to tell you.
Yes, it is.
The philosophy of peace that you teach in the Institute for Peace about nonviolence, is it mimicking your grandfather's philosophy of peace, based on his experiences throughout his life, and are you adding to that through the years since we have come to learn more and understand more about peace? Or do you think that his original message was just filled with that anyway?
No, I think that his, no philosophy can be, should be accepted as a dogma. And so when we look at his writings today, 50 and 100 years later, we can't expect that to be relevant today entirely. He has given us the seed, and we have to now build on that and create a philosophy based on. So I would think that what I am doing is interpreting his philosophy and adding on my own experiences and experiences of other people in the changing times and enhancing his philosophy.
Well, I know that the Mohandas Gandhi Institute has worked to develop programs that apply the principles of nonviolence both locally, nationally, and globally. But in a world of violence such as we live in today, can these same techniques overshadow and overpower things like nuclear power, the war in Iraq, multi-level wars that are being presented to the the world global community? Can we still bring these main points of peace into play here?
Yes, I think so. The tragedy is today that the people don't understand the power that they have. They look elsewhere for power when they have the power in their own hands. And, take, for example, what happened in the Soviet Union. We fought the Soviet Union in a Cold War for so many years. We spent billions and billions of dollars in creating weapons of mass destruction because of the threat of the Soviet Union. And ultimately, the Soviet Union dissolved through people power. We didn't even have to fire one single bullet to destroy Soviet Union. It was the people in the Soviet Union who decided enough is enough and we don't want any more of this. And overnight, the Soviet Union dissolved. So the power of the people is tremendous. It's only if we recognize that power and we come out and express that power, we can transform this world within weeks. But it is getting the people to understand and accept their power that really is a challenge.
How is it, Arun, that small groups of people throughout the global community can so powerfully impose their will on such vast numbers of citizens?
Well, I think that's how it has happened over the years, over the centuries. You know, people with good, sincere ideas who have applied them with sincere dedication, they have influenced people. You know, I mean, take, for instance, Jesus or Prophet Muhammad or the Buddha or all of these great people in religion. They didn't stop to think, you know, who's going to listen to me, what's going to happen, is it worth it? They just went ahead and preached and did what they had to do because they believed in it, and they were sincere and they were determined. And today, what they did thousands of years ago still continues to influence so many people all over the world. So it's the power of the thought as well as the dedication and the sincerity with which you apply it that makes a difference and which eventually makes people understand the wisdom of what was said.
Mahatma Gandhi once said, there is much violence in nonviolence, and nonviolence in violence. And on one occasion, when he was beaten up by some Indians in South Africa, his son asked him, how could I have protected you nonviolently if I was with you? In reply, Gandhi said, it's necessary to protect someone you love. Some violence may be used, but only enough to protect the threatened person. By this statement, Arun, we can see that the Mahatma was not totally pacifistic, but he was quite reasonable in his positions. Do you agree with this kind of a position as to the to limited violence in the name of protection?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, we don't live in a perfect world, and in an imperfect world, somebody may commit some kind of mischief, and we need to protect people in those circumstances. But we must do just enough violence to protect and not to destroy and kill. When we develop weapons of mass destruction and when we create these big armies and all that kind of thing, that is going overboard. It's using violence to the extreme, and that's not appreciated. And it shouldn't be appreciated. What we need to do is to be more compassionate in our relationship with the human beings.
The key to nonviolent resolution is equal to smiling as an angry person, as far as I can see it. How many times have we seen people and if you're smiling at someone that's angry, it's really difficult for them to sustain that anger. The Prime Minister, General Smuts, once told your grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi, that we could deal with the strikers because there was so much anger involved, but we don't know how to deal with you since you're always so considerate towards us. Is that the key?
That's the key to nonviolence. We have to disarm the person through our love and through our respect and through a smiling face. If we respond to the person with anger, then, you know, we are playing into that person's hands. Then that person is more powerful and he knows what buttons to press and to make us react. So we should not react to any kind of negative attitudes or negative thoughts. We should resist them, and resist them with love and understanding.
What types of techniques for peacekeeping do you teach? And I know that you do teach some classes at a local college or university. And your statement was, I believe, that peace begins in your own backyard. Can you? One of the questions that we usually try to ask our guests is, what can we do as a community, as a person, as an individual? What is it that we can do to help promote nonviolence in our world?
We have to first understand what we mean by nonviolence. You know, today when we talk about nonviolence, it's generally the opposite of violence, and we assume that because in our neighborhood or in our street there is no violence taking place, that we are all living in peace. Now, that's not true. We are all contributing to violence in society in ways that we don't even recognize. So it's important for us to first understand what we mean by nonviolence, what we mean by peace, and how do we achieve these things. Now, nonviolence, to understand nonviolence, we have to first understand violence itself. We have to recognize how many ways in which we commit violence. Now, there are two types that I talk about. One is the physical violence, and the other is the non-physical or passive violence. Now, physical violence is all the kinds of violence where we use physical force against each other. All the wars and killings and beatings and murders and rapes and all of these things that we do where we use physical force against people is physical violence. But non-physical or passive violence is the kind of violence where we don't use any physical force and yet we hurt people one way or the other. Now, the waste of resources, the waste of things, because we have so much of it, food and clothing and toys and all of these things that we throw away every day because we have so much and we don't know what to do with it. All of these things are passive violence. When we show no compassion for people who live in poverty, when we say that that's not our business and we don't care what happens to such people, then we are committing passive violence. There's discrimination, oppression, suppression, economic, political, social, cultural, religious, all of these things, you know. There are so many things, I tell you, that we don't even know about these things. And the only way we can really come to know about them is to do what my grandfather made me do. And that is doing introspection every day. Every day I had to examine all the things that I had experienced and I had done to other people and analyze them and put them in their appropriate places on this tree of violence. If it was physical violence, it would go under physical. If it was passive violence, it would go under passive. And within a few months, I filled up a whole wall in my room with acts of passive violence. And that's when I became aware of how much passive violence all of us commit every day. And then the connection between the two is that we commit passive violence all the time, consciously and unconsciously, and that generates anger in the victim. And the victim then uses physical violence to get justice. So it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence. So logically, if we want to put out the fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And the fuel supply comes from each one of us. So unless we become the change that we wish to see in the world, we can't really bring peace in the world. So peace begins with the individual. We have to find peace within ourselves. We have to understand peace. We have to understand nonviolence. And through that understanding, then work towards creating peace and nonviolence in our homes, in our neighborhoods, and from there into our cities and communities and so on. But if we think that we can go into the world and create peace there and stop people from fighting, that's not going to happen, because that's symptomatic. You know, we are dealing with symptoms and not dealing with the disease itself. When I came here to Rochester, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Arun. Please finish your thought.
I was saying when I came here to Rochester and started this institute, everybody thought that I have a magic wand and the very presence of the institute in this city is going to bring peace here and there won't be any fighting in the streets and all that. And I said, that's nonsense. It's not going to happen. This peace will only come when everybody in the city of Rochester realizes that this city is our city and we are going to get involved in trying to solve all the problems that affect the city. And that's how we are going to be able to control violence and crime in the city there. So, you know, we have to become more pragmatic and we have to look at all these issues and deal with the disease and not just treat the symptoms.
Well, I have to tell you, thank you so much for enlightening our audience and listeners as to passive nonviolence. I think that we all obviously understand the meaning of typical violent acts against each other, war and the likes. But I think oftentimes people get confused about passive nonviolence. I think that image is foreign to them, and that sometimes because we place people in society and in our governments in charge of our lives, that somehow we have been relieved of the burden of responsibility for passive violence. And you've made it very, very clear how that works. Arun, we have Steve from Santa Fe that would like to ask you a question. Steve, can you please take the mic and give us your question? I guess we're having some problem with the technical difficulty. Oh, okay, there we go. Steve from Santa Fe. Go right ahead, Steve.
And you, pretty much, Arun, you
Hi, Steve.
Answered my question. Basma asked it to you, and it leaves me just to tell you how great of an honor it is. You know, your grandfather tremendously impacted.
Can you not relay his question?
I'm going to try right now. Go ahead. I'm afraid we didn't hear anything from Steve. If he was talking, we were not able to hear it. So I don't know if somebody not here, we were not able to hear it here. So there might have been a problem. Neither I nor I'm just trying to relay this to her. But anyway, some of the issues that we were talking about as far as the types of violence, one of the techniques that I found to be really fascinating and during some of the marches, especially like prior to the larger marches, the Salt March and so forth, your grandfather and I guess the leaders of the organizers of the marches actually taught the participants never to raise their arms for fear that they would be perceived as antagonizing the situation or antagonizing the police while they were being beaten. Now, that's a pretty tough call right there. How do you...
Well, you know, when we fight a war, a conventional war, we go to with the understanding that we might get killed, and we are willing to sacrifice our life for a cause. So in the same way, we are sacrificing our life for a cause, but we are doing it in a more civilized way. Instead of fighting and killing each other, we are saying that we are not going to fight with you, but you, if you want to fight and kill us, we are willing to accept that. So the sacrifice is the same. Yeah, when you fight and try to kill the opponent, you're sacrificing your life, and in this non-violent way also, you're sacrificing your life for a good cause and doing it in a more civilized way. And like my grandfather said that, I am willing to die, but there is no cause for which I am willing to kill. And I think that's a very profound statement.
Amazing. Amazing. We're going to try taking our call from Steve from Santa Fe again. He's been patiently waiting for us to clear our technical difficulties. So we're going to try this one more time.
Well, hopefully, Arun, you can hear me this time. I think at this point it's...
Can you hear him, Arun?
Basama's asking.
No, I didn't hear anything.
You've answered it quite eloquently.
No, we are not hearing this.
By the way, but your grandfather, there's a handful of people that has affected my life.
Let's see if we can...
And your grandfather was one of them.
Get this. I guess it isn't going to work tonight. We're having some technical difficulties, and we'll just go on with our talk.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Okay. Again, I'm afraid. Now, what I will ask, if you, any audience members have questions, you can relay them to me through our room moderators, and they would be more than happy to give me the questions. So we'll go from there. You know, your programs that you get involved in, Arun, in the capacity of teaching your nonviolence across the country and in different nations, in Canada, always have similar themes. And I wonder how, if you can enlighten us on which of the areas that you are actively working within. You know, things like sweatshops, restorative justice, torture victims and survivors, especially with the light of what's been going on in with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. These are things that are coming up over and over, and a lot of the information that I've been researching about you. How do you handle these things, and what do you take a political stand on any of it?
Oh, yeah, I do take a political stand. I am against all of these kinds of acts of violence. In fact, I consider this to be a part of the culture of violence that dominates human society today. Over the centuries, we have become so conditioned by violence that it has seeped into our very beings. It determines our relationships with each other. It determines how we talk with each other. It determines every aspect of human life there. So it's become a very strong and very powerful culture of violence in human society. And what we need to do is to replace that culture of violence with a culture of nonviolence. Otherwise, we are doomed to death and destruction. I mean, what we are seeing today in terms of violence is in another 50 years, it's going to be nothing. The escalation of violence is going to grow so much in 50 years or even less than that, that it will boggle our minds. So, you know, we are not going to be able to control this simply by using force or trying to define the word between the good and the bad and saying that we will go and kill all the bad people and make this world better. That's impossible to do because nobody is good or nobody is bad. The good and bad exists in every one of us. You know, there's a beautiful saying by the Native Americans, and which also has some roots in the Eastern culture also. That is that there is a good tiger and a bad tiger in every one of us. And when the Native American grandfather told this to his grandson asked him, which is the more stronger of the two tigers? And his grandfather told him, the one that you nurture becomes stronger. And the trouble is, the one that you feed becomes stronger. And we always feed the evil within us, the evil tiger within us. And that's why we act, you know, badly. So, you know, we can't go and kill everybody in the human race because everybody has a bad streak or a good streak.
We have another caller, I believe, Mike from California.
Mm-hmm. Hello. Hello, Arun.
Hi,
it's
Mike.
An honor to talk to you. My question is
Thank
about
you, Mike.
War. Many people justify war as an act of defense. Is violence ever justifiable as a way of defending?
It's only justifiable in a situation of one-on-one, like, you know, you walking down the street and somebody attacking you. At that moment, if I am there or if somebody else is there and we see this, we step in to protect you, that is justified. But the same cannot be used in a national situation like a war, because that is an afterthought. It's not immediate reaction. You know what I mean? You know, for instance, let me explain it in another sense. You know, the passengers of the aircraft on 9/11 who fought the terrorists and crashed the plane in Philadelphia?
Yes.
Now, I think what they did was a very tremendous act of nonviolence because they saw the danger that these people were leading them into, and they decided they were not going to let this succeed, and they fought the terrorists, and they sacrificed their lives, and they protected the people that they were going to harm by crashing the plane. But you cannot use the same theory to what President Bush did later on by declaring war and saying, I'm going to fight a war against terrorists and eliminate all terrorists. Because that is not protection. That is seeking revenge. Because it was after the fact. And what we are doing now is we want them to know that nobody can mess around with the United States and get away with it. And that is an aggressive act. It's not protection at all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Arun, obviously your thoughts on any war are obvious because of your stand and your position.
Right.
Let's assume the opposite were true and we were attacked here in the United States. Do we have the right of self-defense as long as they are in our borders? Is that something that is acceptable?
Well,
because,
yes.
Again, I think you're right that so few people really understand the issues of what is defending oneself, when do we have legitimate rights for defense, and when is it an aggressive action? And it's a very fine line in the minds of many people.
Yeah, it is very fine. I mean, you know, even going back to 9/11, I would say that when when they realized that the aircraft was hijacked and they were up to something no good. At that time, if the Air Force had gone up and shot the airplanes to protect them from, you know, doing what they did, that would have been understandable. And I would say that that is not justified action, but necessary action. Now, there's a difference between justifying violence and considering it to be necessary. So I would say that would be necessary to do. But if we seek revenge afterwards, after they crash the planes and all that, then that is revenge, and it's not something to protect.
We have another call, and it is our friend Steve from Santa Fe. He's called through on the phone lines. He's really excited about talking to you, Steve.
But hopefully you can hear me this time, Basma.
Yes, Steve, I'm glad that you finally got through.
Yes, sir. And all I wanted to say, you answered my question, but it's such a great honor to be able to listen to you and to talk to you. Your grandfather, there's just a handful of people that have affected my life. Your grandfather was one of them. And it's the greatest honor to be able to explain to his grandson how it has. And you've already answered my question on what I, as an American citizen, can do to change this. But hopefully maybe you've got something more. You know, I've been involved in the protests, in the and you know, trying to make a difference. And you know, it almost looks bleak at this point. But you know, but thank you, sir. And thank you for your grandfather.
You're
and
most
hopefully
welcome, Steve.
Down the road he'll realize that.
Yes, thank you very much, Steve. But I'd like to share with you a story that my grandfather used to be very fond of telling us. It's a story of the starfish. You may have heard this somewhere else too. But it's the man who went to the beach one day for his early morning constitutional walk. And he saw in the, you know, there was not enough daylight, but, you know, dawn was just about breaking. So he saw somebody near the waterline picking up something and throwing into the water. So he went there out of curiosity to ask him what he was doing. And when he asked him, the man said, well, during the night, the tide came in and washed all the starfish ashore. And now the tide has gone out and the starfish are all stranded on the beach. And when the sun comes out, they will all perish. So he started throwing them back into the water. So the second man who had come to the beach and saw him, saw the whole beach strewn with starfish. And he said, you're not going to be able to save all of them, so why bother? What's the difference? And at that moment, he had one starfish that he was about to throw into the water. And he said, it makes a hell of a difference to this guy. Now, the moral of that story is that the fellow saw the problem that all the starfish were there on the stranded on the beach, but he didn't wait to find out how many he was going to be able to save. He just got down and started throwing as many as he could into the water. But the second guy who came and saw the problem, and he said that, I can't save all of them, so why bother saving any of them? Now, that is where we are. We look at the whole world problem, and we get overwhelmed, and we say that we can't solve all these problems, so why bother? Let's just flow with the tide. But if we start solving small problems that are around us, eventually, you know, it will all multiply and grow, and we will be able to solve all the problems of the world. So, you know, we have to just do as much as we can, where we can, and be satisfied with that, and eventually the world will change.
I have a question from one of our audience members. I'm not sure if I understand it, Arun, but this is the question. Could you see a similar action that Gandhi used working in the United States, or are there too many cultural differences to see this happening? When they say similar action, I'm going to assume just in the modality of action.
I think the best example is what Dr. Martin Luther King did here in the United States for civil rights. He used nonviolence to gain civil rights for the African American people, and I think he was one of the few people who really understood Gandhi's philosophy properly and was able to apply it effectively in this country. So that is there, and there are other examples, smaller examples of people doing wonderful things, transforming society peacefully. There's Doris Day, the Catholic workers. There are so many groups, small groups and larger groups, who are doing wonderful work there.
You know, there was a connection between Luther King. Many times people have made the connection between them. You did some work in the past, starting with, I believe it was your grandfather's birthday and Martin Luther King's birthday. Can you talk to us about that?
1998 was the 50th memorial anniversary of my grandfather. It was 50 years since his assassination. And that was in 1998. So when I was thinking about how to celebrate this occasion meaningfully, I realized that in the same year, it was Dr. Martin Luther King's 30th memorial anniversary. And that happened, you know, Dr. King was assassinated on 4th of April. My grandfather was assassinated on 30th of January. And so we link the two anniversaries, 30th of January and 4th of April, and that 64-day period was declared as a season for nonviolence.
Yes.
And I just went around the country and talked to people and inspired communities to do whatever they could to take us a few steps closer to the dream that both of them shared, the dream of creating a peaceful and harmonious a society of peace and harmony. And I'm very glad to say that there are about nearly 300 communities in the country which are working in their neighborhoods to bring about this kind of peace and harmony there. So, you know, a little idea can go a long way. And it's every year we get more and more communities involved in it, and it keeps growing there. And so, you know, one day I think it will transform the world.
And your wife, your lovely wife, Sunanda, has been side by side with you throughout all of this.
Yes, she was always with me. And unfortunately, on February 21st, she passed away. And it was after 49 years of our marriage. And I was planning to give her a surprise for the 50th wedding anniversary. But she surprised me by passing away in her sleep. And today happens to be the 6th month. You know, it's exactly 6 months to the day she passed away. And
well, I know that must be an incredible loss in your life and your family's life, and I know to the life and spirit of the institute that you both founded.
Yes, indeed, it has been a tremendous loss to all of us, and we have decided to memorialize her life by starting a school for poor children, very poor children, in a village in India. And this is going to be a work of love and dedication, and we have been asking friends and people to contribute whatever they can to make this dream possible. And so I'd like to share this with your listeners. if anybody would like to contribute to the building of this school and changing the life of poor children in the villages there, could donate to this cause.
Where can they send it? Would they send it directly to the institute?
Yes, they can send it to the institute. They could send a check made out in the name of Gandhi Institute. And in the memo side, they can write for Sunanda's memorial so that it's earmarked for that particular purpose there.
Well, you heard it, folks. That would be going in honor, in memoriam, in honor of Sunanda Gandhi, Arun's late wife, who has recently passed away. And thank you for talking about her. I know that it is so soon. And we just wanted to allow everybody to understand how deeply involved she was in this right from the very beginning.
We were together for 51 years, and, you know, we did everything together as partners in life. And it was, you know, it was a tremendous 51 years full of love and joy and you know, the satisfaction of working together. And she
What I was going to say is that our audience members are definitely giving you condolences and are just, you know, deeply, deeply regretful for your loss.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much.
One question before we leave. The issue of globalization, do you find that to be an issue of violence or passive violence?
It is an issue of violence in the sense that globalization benefits the rich nations, people who can produce, you know, mass production. It's not production for the masses, but mass production, you know, it's overwhelming the poorer nations and making the poor people poorer. It's a very negative thing. You know, I'll give you an example that when we were living in India, we started several cooperative ventures to help the poor people through self-help methods. And these programs were business programs on a cooperative basis. And they were running beautifully until globalization came in. And now the market in India are flooded with Japanese and foreign-made cloth that is so much cheaper than handmade cloth. And so these people are being run out of their business, and they can't compete with machine-made things. And so, you know, it's very difficult. So people who struggle to come up and stand on their feet are suddenly being, you know, their legs are cut off and the ground has been cut off from under their feet. And they're back again to square one. So what we need is true globalization of cultures and people coming together to help and work with each other, to help each other, not dominate each other.
Absolutely. That is an amazing statement, that last statement, and I'm afraid we do have to wrap it up. Arun, this has been an incredible interview. Our blessings to you and to your family and to your efforts. Again,
thank you
for
those
of you that want to make a donation to the school in India, you can contact the Arun Institute, the Arun's Institute for Nonviolence. And his website is on the Internet, and we've also been putting it into the room. Our next week is Philippe Diaz, film director and founder of the Cinema Libre Studios, and that'll be August 28th at 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Arun, thank you so much, and blessings to you, my friend.
Nice talking
Good luck.
To you. Bye.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll see you all next week. This land is mine.
waters, this land was made for you and me. That when walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts, and all around me voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Oh, well, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, this land is mine, there from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.